one of the things that we want to do is just look at various tools that you can utilize to improve the quality of your own study. And what we're going to look at is study materials, use of key verses and outlines, and various other disciplines that may aid in our study. Grants, description. And I've got a question, if I should have asked, has there been a problem in using outlines? I just thought that was an odd thing to question about outlines. And we're going to address some of the pitfalls that may come up in dealing with outlines. But a lot of this is going to be stop and look at it. I want to ask you a question. Which Bibles are free of doctrinal issues and therefore desirable? Richard says none. Anybody want to agree with that or disagree with that? Well, okay, I see what you're meaning. Problematic doctrinal issues then. If everybody's stumped, that's good. Because, in essence, all have doctrinal issues that create problems for a Christian to be able to do the things that are necessary. And I guess the real thing is, which ones should be avoided in this. We're going to look at some of the doctrinal issues that we see in all translations. Can anybody think of a doctrinal issue that's present in almost all translations in the English language anyway, that we all need to be aware of? What was that? That's exactly it. Almost all English translations translate a Greek word into a transliteration, an invented word in English, baptize, baptism. And that is a doctrinal issue. Because why? Why is that a doctrinal issue? You can define it as you see it to be. And that's exactly what the majority of the Christian world has done. The majority, and I get in issues with Barry Poynter over this, his usage of mainstream all the time, because mainstream Christianity is what? What is it? Roman Catholicism. That is mainstream Christianity. If you're going to say, well, the majority represent the mainstream, then it is Roman Catholicism. In Protestantism, the mainstream is Baptist groups. So I do not like the term mainstream whatsoever, because it is a derogatory term. It is a derogatory term, but that's neither here nor there. Mainstream Christianity defines baptism as what? Sprinkling. And that's the majority. It has issued, put forth, problems for people to be obedient to God's will because of that. So that is a major doctrinal issue. I think as we get to looking at, some of the other items, you'll find that there are other things that are apparent. Baptize in church. Which translations are the most sound then? Okay. Translate, paraphrase. Anybody read this? You can't read that. It's Tyndale's translation of the New Testament. And does anybody know how he translates baptizo? He's our first one that says baptize. Now, when he comes to Ecclesia, which is church, is anybody familiar with how he translates that? Congregation. Congregation. There is another one that translates that. The Jewish New Testament translates baptizo as immerse. Consistently throughout, immerse. It also translates ecclesia as community. Community of believers. And that is pretty good. Now, there are still problems with both of these. Both are not free of problems. And Tyndale is basically where almost all English translations derive from. Almost all come from here. Well, we'll come back a little bit. Baptize, according to Thayer, says properly to dip, repeatedly emerge, submerge, and in Greek writing, it was used to describe sunken vessels. Now, you don't describe a sunken vessel as one that's been sprinkled, or even water poured on it. It's damp. A second meaning, to cleanse by dipping or submerging, to wash, to make clean with water. Those are the words that translators could have utilized in English to get a clear definition. And they didn't. Now, that creates all sorts of problems as to why. And interestingly enough, documents that relate to the translation of the King James don't reveal why they did that, other than this. When they were issued the command to make an English translation with the authorization of King James. Now, it's interesting. He authorized it, but he's never accepted it. He never accepted that thing because he didn't want the translation in the first place. Does anybody know why he went ahead and authorized it? This is one of those disciplines that come into play in helping us to understand the scriptures. King James was from Scotland, a so-called Protestant nation where Puritans, or the people that we would call Puritans, were gaining in popularity. And as a boy king, he was dominated by them. It was assumed that when Elizabeth died and he came to take the crown of England, that he would be a Puritan. And the Puritans were ecstatic that he was coming. What they didn't know was he resented the Puritans greatly for dominating him. And it was his decision that as he came to the throne in England, that he would no longer be under their domination. In 1604, he held a great meeting. And the first thing that he really wanted to accomplish was to eliminate the Puritans altogether, by reason. Get them out of the way, out of the picture politically, economically, and certainly religiously. In the conclusion of it, he came away frightened by his meeting with them. His conclusion was that they didn't care whether they had a king or not, which was true. They didn't care. And he summed up the meeting by saying, well, no bishops, no king, and they were happy with that. And so that was when he authorized them the translation, because he wanted to get rid of the Geneva Bible. The Geneva Bible was the Bible of the Puritans. It is the Bible that New England was founded on. A lot of times we think, well, the King James was what came here to the U.S. Well, it didn't. The King James wasn't even popular in England until after the Civil War, when they were looking for all kinds of compromises. So, he wanted to get rid of the King James, or the Geneva Bible, and authorize the translation. He only issued two orders concerning the translation. One was that they were to, as little as possible, make changes in current English translations, meaning the Tyndale. The Bishop's Bible, the Coverdale Bible, were all variations of the Tyndale Bible. And it's estimated by those who do such things that 85 to close to 90% of the King James is a direct quotation of Tyndale. So this is one translation that you need to be familiar with, because it's the roots of where all our English Bibles come from. And the second order that he gave concerned the word church. Now, you've got this on a page in here because you can't read that, I don't suppose, from that far, very far back. But this is, again, Thayer's definition. And the Greek word means called out or forth. Properly, a gathering of citizens called out from their home into some public place and assembly. In a Christian sense, an assembly of Christians gathered to worship, for worship. A company of Christians. And that's the way that this could be translated. And the only issue or statement about translation in itself that King James mandated had to be in the King James laws, ecclesia was not to be translated anything other than church. Now why? Why did he do that? Everybody hear that? Tom said to defend the Church of England, and that's exactly right. What he wanted was this whole Church of England structure, which the head of that is the king, followed by the Archbishop of Canterbury, followed by the bishops, going on down in the pyramid to those who were the priests in the church. And to him, that word represented all of that structure. And I think it does to us today. Because when people talk about the church, they talk about the whole ball of wax. We look at the entire hierarchy of it. Who's the president of your organization? Who's your bishops? And we want to see that because that's what that word honestly means to us. So when church is used, it's a doctrinal issue because it tries to bring in then whether it's the Roman Catholic hierarchy, the Church of England, what shall soon be the American Episcopalian hierarchy, the Methodist, the Presbyterian hierarchy, the Nazarene hierarchy, it's all embodied in that word. And God's plan was totally different. His structure is so unorganized, if you want to look at it. We have one head. And we have members who have various functions within that. And King James, I think, did us a horrible disservice in that. But to him, it was a defense of his crown. He really was frightened, and he had reading to do. Because if you look at it, those Puritans didn't quite leave. Some of them did leave England about that time. They went over to Holland. Some went on further into Europe. And, of course, eventually some came to the United States. But before they all left, they created a civil war in England that actually was the catalyst for making the King James the compromised Bible of basically the English-speaking world. By the time that Cromwell was displaced, everybody was tired of Puritans in England. And they sure didn't want their Geneva Bible anymore. And nobody was very happy with the Great Bible. And so the compromise was the King James. The King James really didn't get popular in the United States until in the lower 1700s into the middle 1700s. So America wasn't founded on the King James. We always get that picture that it wasn't. And it's for certain that King James wasn't welcome in New England. Okay. Yes. Congregation and immerse. Yes. Somebody was distributing computer copy of the Geneva Bible with the notes. That's the key thing that If you've ever wondered why there are not a lot of notes in the King James, it's because Richard Bancroft, who was the chairman of the organization of the King James translation, wanted to limit that because it was the notes that went along with the translation that were so anti-bishops, anti-church hierarchy, that that's the reason the King James doesn't have a lot of notes in it. That's interesting. In the past 13 years, there's been an explosion of information about the King James. For years and years and years, we had no idea what they were about, the translators, and what motivated them, because all documents concerning their work was gone, or so it was thought. It was thought that they either didn't make notes and kept them, or that they were just lost, but in 1993 or 1995, several cases at Oxford were found in a storage unit, and there they all were. The organization, the name of every one of the translators, and how they went about it. One thing about the King James, and it says so in the opening, if you've got a good King James that has the dedication page in it, it outlines what the purpose was. It was to be read in all the churches. And that's a key element. It was to sound good. In fact, the last revision of the King James was done without any of the final editors having a copy of the book in front of them. And somebody read it because they wanted to hear how it sounded. And very honestly, to my ears and to a lot of almost, and it's not matched by any other translation. Now, it may not make them, but it has the best sound issue. You hear them read from one translation. Try to have some flows. It will flow a whole lot of things. So if somebody would go there, Lonnie's the one before. It's always a good idea to use various translations. And if you read the King James, the New King James, on the listing of the instruments that are found in Daniel the third chapter in the fifth verse, they're the same. But now when you get to the NIV, or excuse me, the King James and the New King James, and the New American Standard all have various translations for that. The instruments, and as you'll note, probably have, that there's confusion about what some of the instruments were. But Thomas Nelson, who owns the copyright on the New King James, has one less instrument than everybody else. One less. Now, that's a really minor thing, isn't it? I mean, who cares whether they missed one instrument? Or do we care? Does it bother you that they may have missed one? Sure did me. And I really don't care if they have the instrument there. What bothers me is, were they so sloppy in their translation work that they missed something? And if they miss something there that's so inconsequential as an instrument, what else might they have missed that might be more important? So I wrote them. And they were very nice. They wrote back to me. And I want to read a portion of this. This is the Bible editor, Thomas Nelson. And he says this. Thank you for your letter concerning the New King James Version. I will try to clarify for you the situation with Daniel 3:5, also 3:10 and 15. These three verses are among the portions of Daniel that are written in Aramaic language rather than in Hebrew. The Aramaic word sumponia is the word that you see translated as the sixth instrument in some English translations. Scholars are not certain as to how this word should be translated. The word occurs only in these three versions of Daniel, so we are not helped with its meaning by any other place in the Bible. Many scholars do think that the word is a musical instrument. Bagpipes, double pipes have been suggested. And as you look at the various translations, you see it translated in those kind of ways. However, other scholars think that the word means concord or agreement. Okay, what is a symphony? It's coming together with instruments to make a jointed sound. And then he continues, it appears that the evidence for this position comes from the Syriac word. It is true that our English word symphony is related to the Aramaic word symphonia, and the meaning of the English symphony is consonants or harmony of sound. The New King James has chosen this option for translating symphonia in symphony. When you hear these instruments in symphony, so they've got them all there. That's interesting. Gives me a little bit more confidence in the work. Also have to make notation if they don't agree with the others. And that sometimes you're going to find. The one that really bothers me is in 1 Corinthians 11:16. The King James, New King James, this is this whole section dealing with head covering, or more appropriately, veiling of women. And after he goes through a situation explaining how they can treat this and really avoiding the question altogether, he gives them an out without having to really honestly answer directly the question. But he then concludes, if any man will be contentious, we have no other custom except the NIV, New American Standard, Revised Standard, New Revised Standard, all say no. What did I say? King James says no such. No such. And all the others say no other. Now, what's the difference between such and other? Quite a bit. What is it, then? Everybody catch that? You agree with that? Now, one of the things that you can do, and these are one of the disciplines that we're going to look at later on, is how's that word translated elsewhere? And if you do an Englishman's concordance search for the Greek word that's translated as such in the New King James and the King James, or more appropriately, look in the NIV or the New American Standard, never once do the others translate that other in all other situations. So that when you see that kind of an oddity, it's a red light. So I wrote them. Wrote the NIV. I wrote the NIV, the ownership of the copyright. I always like that. People owning the copyrights of the Word of God. The NIV, when it first came out, if you've got one of the very first copies, it says that you can only read 49 verses. So, technically, to avoid violating American laws, if you were reading a chapter that had more than 49 verses, you stopped and that's it. You were finished. They've changed that in later. But the very first edition that they had had a limitation of 49 verses. Zondervan owns that. I wrote them. And he says, you have no doubt noted that most English translations have rendered no such practice. And At one time, that's correct. Now, it's the other way. And it's interesting because I don't think anybody follows what that says. And I find that really interesting because here's what he goes on ahead and says. And that is indeed more literal rendering of the Greek expression. He acknowledges that's the right way, such. Okay, so the translator is going to go ahead and do something contrary to what he knows. Why? Why would somebody do that? Well, for doctrinal reasons. And that's a treacherous field to get into. Very treacherous. He goes ahead and says, virtually all readers of the literal English translation misconstrued Paul's intent. What he's saying is, we have an insight to Paul that all you others don't. And so he goes ahead and he just simply indicates, we have rendered the clause as they have, we have no other custom, to make clear to the vast majority of readers our perception. The Lockman Foundation, which owns the copyright to the New American Standard, essentially says the same thing. They mistranslated it to get what they thought was their view of what Paul said. Rather than give that information to you and let you make the decision, they made it for you. So, always be aware that in the case of translations, whether it's the King James, New King James, the NIV, the New American Standard Update, or whatever, they are filled with doctrinal issues. So, one of the questions Grant asked was, which one's the best? Which translation is the best? And I can't really answer that because, in fact, there are problems with all. You just have to be aware of it. Okay, what was their question to him? Do you recall that? Remember, in the 1 Corinthians, the reason for that letter was in response to their written questions to him. Unfortunately, we don't have the questions that they gave. We do not get to that problem until we get to the 6th chapter, where he finally comes around to these things, the things you wrote to me about. And so here's one of those questions. Should women be veiled or unveiled when they are participating in the services? And actually, I think that may be kind of next. No. History of the locality will help us out on that. So a lot of times our understanding of the Bible is not limited to the Bible. Can I come back to that? Okay, we'll come back to that. Don't let me get away without that. Okay. Everybody for your, you probably have, your own study Bible. And a library. The one that everybody misses is this. Honestly, this is the beginning of it. You need a good English dictionary. Without that, all your commentaries are really not as effective. Anything else that you have, it starts here. Because that's our language. That's our language. And sadly enough, it's not taught very well in our school systems. Now, I'm not going to blame the teachers necessarily. I'm going to blame the whole structure system that has allowed that thing to happen. So, no matter how well you are educated, keep this. Now, there's probably somebody that has the whole thing memorized. And you don't need it. When I can't remember where my keys are, I need it. Okay? But, the very basic Strongs, Thayers, Brown Drivers, and Brig, and English loose concordance. I don't have any commentary about that. Now, I'm not saying don't use them. But be cautious of them. I had one individual tell me that he'd been given a set of Zur's commentary. So he never looked at it. Had no intention. And in part I understand what he was saying, but at the same time, that man had a lot of intelligence that I don't. And if he was living, I'd ask him. And the same individual asked a lot of other people their opinions, but he wouldn't ask a dead man. And unfortunately, some of the best writers are dead. There's some good restoration-type men who wrote outstanding commentaries. J.W. McGarvey wrote several. His commentary on Book of Acts is just a hallmark. He's dead. I can't ask him. But he left it. But if this man is saying, well, Zur was just a man, I agree with him. He's a man that has an opinion. And that's the approach you should take. And truthfully, if you stop and think about it, so are the dictionaries. So always keep an open mind, but the more you educate yourself, the better able you are to deal with those things. Well, non-biblical aids, Josephus, Philo, Herodotus, Suetonius, Eusebius, Gibbons, Durant, and there's a host of other things that are being written in today's time. As I mentioned, when documents were found on King James, there have been several good books come out since that time that give you the insights of the translation. If you run into those kind of things, buy them. They're good. Give you solid information. There are a number of historians. Now, what's the problem with a historian? Rick! Yeah. What's the problem with a historian? Start with Josephus. He reports from his own viewpoint, isn't it? His view of the facts are from his viewpoint. And try as they might, Herodotus is defined as the modern historian, the father of all modern historians. And Herodotus writes from his viewpoint, from his background, from his upbringing, from his exposure. Same when you get down into more modern times. Eusebius is an interesting one because he was in the groundwork, the founding of the church and state. And so, yeah, his viewpoints are going to be to support that thing and make it look good. But you have to know their viewpoint, and then you can start drawing conclusions. The same with Durant and Gibbons. Gibbons is the decline and fall of the Roman Empire, and Durant's is the history of civilization. The other thing that especially historians are always subject to in a problem area is there's new information to be found. And a new piece of information can make obsolete an entire conclusion that a historian may have drawn. The same in medicine. There have been so many things tossed out about what works and what doesn't work because new things are found. And we tend to say, well, history's a lock. Well, no, it's not. Well, it's not. Our understanding of the King James has totally changed by the documents that have been found. It truly is one of the greatest finds in the last 100 years. as far as the impact that the King James had on the Western world. So, spend time with these things. Yeah. One of the great things, our biblical Bibles, our Bibles on the computer, will probably have a great percentage of these things packaged into them and make it just wonderful to be flipping through. It's, to me, a tremendous aid in going through Josephus, because it just brings it faster than the book itself will. Everybody, yes, John. Well, as most people know, I use the New King James. It crosses a lot of boundaries that work well with people. I would rather recommend things not to get. I would recommend stay away from the New American Standard. There was a question here. Okay. When the translators got close to finished with the New American Standard, they realized they missed their goal. Part of their goal was to put it in everyday English, and they missed it. They put a stiff, wooden, archaic form of English, but they were out of money. And the Lockman Foundation that had been paying for it couldn't get new monies. So they made a conscious decision to sell a bad translation, raise capital, to do what they wanted. Now, I would buy the New American Update. It's a good one. It's a good one, other than the minor doctrinal issues. It's a good one. The NIV is one that I really can't recommend. Because more times than not, it explains a verse rather than translate it. Now, almost in every case, they explain it correctly. But again, it's an explanation as opposed to a translation. In fact, is anybody familiar with the flesh test? What's that, Tom? No, flesh test. F-L-E-S-C-H. Flesh test. Flesh is best known by his book, Why Johnny Can't Read. And in the process of evaluating, documents, he developed a method of telling how difficult a thing is to read. And oddly enough, the NIV scores a higher grade level of understanding than the King James in most occasions. Why? Because they have choppy grammar. They really have a lot of what you call comma splices in it. And so the net result is it honestly is not as easy to understand as the King James, which they were trying to thwart. So those are two that I wouldn't recommend. Yes.
When you said flesh test, I hadn't heard it all, but one of the problems I understand to be is that rather than translate flesh.
Oh, okay. Sinful nature. Sinful nature.
Which is not.
Yeah. And it explains it, doesn't it? Mm-hmm. It doesn't translate it. And so many times in the NIV they explain rather than translate.
I think that's not a good explanation. That's more of their Calvinism.
Well, I think it's their. It gets back to exactly why they translated. They wanted to tell you what their doctrine was, rather than let you know what God's doctrine was. King James. The interesting thing about the King James is it's been around so long, it's so well documented, that everybody knows where the problems are. And the odd thing is, the two that I find the most critical, the translation of baptizo to baptize and ecclesia as to church, nobody gets upset about. Those are the two critical. And I can't criticize the King James because everybody else did it, with the exception of this one. And that's no real reason. I would recommend that for a student that you have this, because it is a very interesting presentation. But that's not a... Don't use that as a conclusion. So King James and New King James are the two that I would recommend anybody. Big print or little print. Okay. Does that help? What do you recommend? Uh-huh. There's some really bad... I've not included the Living Translation. That's not a translation whatsoever. A Living Bible, that's what it is. Living Bible. Or the New Living. They are not translations. They are strictly a commentary, and that's it. No, and I use that. It's, to me, better than the NIV. If you want that type, and oddly enough, I think the flesh test on it, as they publish it, is an 8th grade reading level. And you know what government documents strive to hit on a flesh test? 5th grade. Started out 8th grade, and it's down to 5th grade. And that's sad. The King James, by the way, is in excess of high school. The NIV is just a tad ahead of it. So the critics that say the NIV dumbs down it doesn't. And that's the interesting thing, how deceptive our world is. What looks dumb is not. To fully understand it, you've got to have a better education. The New King James comes down. One of the other notes on the King James, you know why they have thee, thou, and so forth, John does? You know why it was thee, thou, and thine? No. It was not. That's the odd thing. We assume it was. And you ask, well, why didn't they put you and so forth in there? Because King James' instructions said, make minimal changes in the existing ones. Well, Tyndale wrote his translation that became available in 1535. Tyndale had been away from England for a fair amount of time. And even at his time, it was starting to wane in use. Go another 100 years, and yeah, people did use that, but it wasn't common. It wasn't the street vernacular of London. And so they maybe were a little more familiar than we, but it wasn't their tongue either. And so, throw in a different pronoun system, and the King James just changes entirely in its understandability. Okay, this is something you're going to have to do to take a couple of minutes. I think one of the greatest study helps is to find a key verse to a book. And I've got two real easy ones here. Take a couple of minutes. And I will tell you that both key verses are in the first chapter of Acts and James. You take a moment and see if you can find the key verses of those two books. By key, I mean it's sort of like the key of a building. That it's the thing, the keystone that holds everything together. And everything kind of flows right around that. These are the two easiest in the New Testament to find.
That's a good idea for a sermon, too.
Uh-huh. And just, like an arch, build it around there. Acts. Anybody have a key verse? Why? It is, isn't it? And that's what happens, isn't it? The whole story then revolves around there, where it starts there in Jerusalem, it goes out, and keeps going out until finally we get Paul in Europe. And so that when you look at it then, you look at the rest of this book and you say that, okay, James, the first chapter then. This is a little more subtle in this one. Actually, kind of two verses to get the full sentence. Go ahead. Yes. Uh-huh. Well, go ahead and pick up 7 and 8 too in that.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. That's the key. Everything else revolves around that. You see what he's talking about? Here's the double-minded man. Well, how do you define the double-minded man? Well, it's the one that says and doesn't do it. It's the one that favors certain people and doesn't favor others. It's the double-minded man. And the benefit, then, is found in that verse 5 and 6, isn't it? If we're not that double-minded man. That's a good thing. Now, that leads into outlines. Take a moment and tell me the advantages of an outline. Make a couple notes. Advantages. Okay, either way. Let's do it both ways then. You and somebody else's. Advantages of it. Well, okay, if it's somebody else that's done it for you. We're all for that. Which is the problem with Christianity, isn't it? If I could get Tom to do it for me, if he can obey God, and that satisfies for me, then that works, doesn't it? And believe it or not, I think a lot of our denominational friends feel that way. If you ask them situations, they'll say, well, the preacher knows that. Well, that's good for him. That'll be good for you. Good for him. And this goes into other religions. I used to work with a Jewish man, and I popped into his office on the 10th day of the first month of the Jewish New Year, and I said, did you pick out your land today? He said, well, I don't know about that. He said, that's the rabbi's supposed to know about that. Okay. And I thought, how sad. And then I thought, how's that different than a Methodist or a Baptist or a Catholic? It's not my job. That's the priest's job. That's the preacher's job. So there's a universality in that. Okay, advantages of outlines then. Give me some thoughts. Hopefully. Very good point. This is a helpful thing, isn't it? Get the, honestly, if we were looking at this, an outline is actually the skeleton, isn't it? Now, that's really what it is. Now, any other advantages that you see of that? It does, doesn't it? It sometimes a study can be chaos because it doesn't have a pointed direction that you're headed to, and an outline can help in that. Very much so. Yes. It's helpful in that because, in part, you'll see things that you should be looking for as you come to them. Now, disadvantages. Uh-huh. What good is a skeleton without tendons, ligaments, muscles? What good are all of them without food, blood, oxygen, nutrients? Not much good. Does anybody know why Zur fashioned his commentary in the way that he did? Does anybody have copies of, like, McGarvey? His commentaries. How does he present them in the book? What's his format? Let's say when he's got Acts 1 and 1, how does he present that? Aha! What does Zur do? He doesn't have that verse in there, does he? And that's the key element here. Because he never wanted anybody to be able to easily stand up, and although there have been congregations that have done that, stand up there and read that. But if you read it, your initial reaction is, what's he talking about? With McGarvey and most others, they have a series of verses put up there, and in the commentary, meaning you don't need the Bible. And with an outline, there's a great tendency to say, what do we need with the rest of this, these other superfluous words? Why don't we just get to the gist of the matter? Get to the heart of it. And that's a real danger in our world. We're busy. It's harder and harder to get people to come into a Bible study service. Think about your own congregations. When the time starts for Bible class, how many people are there? When it comes time for the main portion of the service, people are there. Steve Owens was speaking at a small congregation. He sat toward the front. And when he walked in, I think he said there were about 4 or 5 people there. And by the time that there was a break after the class, there were about 30 people there. They just kept coming in, kept coming in, kept coming in. Well, why? Because if you just put out a skeleton, that's okay. Don't bother me with the detail. Don't get me with the nuts and the bolts of this whole thing and all the other trappings that go with it. Just give me the heart of this and let's go. Next page. And that's one of the biggest problems in congregations and studying, in particular the Old Testament. People don't want to do that. Invariably, when we come to genealogy lists, what happens so often? Next page, let's go on. There's a purpose for every name that's listed in the Bible. And it may be our task to try to find out why. And that's the great mystery for us. Solvable, it's workable. But unfortunately, we overlook a lot. Those are advantages and disadvantages.
That's a really good point about disadvantages. And it used to be considered a church issue. But it's not really an agency issue nowadays. But whether or not your church views a curriculum or something like that is an issue for the reason that we're talking about. It comes to be dependent upon, and there's less actual study done, so it's more dependent on that. I've been to a few places where they've done it. One time I was in a congregation, the guy almost said, I didn't even know why we did anything. He said, I didn't agree with what you said about this chapter, and as they were tied to it.
I grew up in the Presbyterian Church. And from the time that I was in first grade reading, and I'll admit my experience is different than most churches of Christ. I had, I think, 20 of my classmates who were in my class alone. So it's a little different when our kids go off to a classroom to study. There may be 3 or 4, and you've probably gone 4 or 5 age levels to achieve that, and we had one grade where that was there. Now, that provided a lot of interaction, but it also, we never saw a Bible. Never once, from first grade to 12th grade, did I ever see a Bible in our classroom. We had a textbook. We had an extensive textbook. And at the start of every chapter, there was a verse. What do I need with a Bible? I got a verse. And unfortunately, when we get into these prepared things, there are advantages to the prepared things. First of all, chances are good that the one preparing it has had an editor to go over a lot of things. So the presentation is probably better from a grammatical standpoint, from a professional type of appearance. It's better. But at the same time, it may not be better when it comes to the terms of what God said. And you may end up with, I don't agree with this, but what am I supposed to do? Well, that's some of those disadvantages. Now, a number of our so-called Church of Christ publishers make a lot of money out of these, don't they? They send these kind of programs out. Some of them are good. But they also promote a degree of laziness. Let somebody else do it. And that's what we want to learn. Who, what, when, where, why, how? Is anybody familiar with that? Journalism. Do you know where that came from, Tom? Not quite. You're in that time frame, but when the electronic age in America was dawning, by that I mean telegraph, the first war in which there was instant reporting of it was the Civil War. And for the first time in world history, reporters from various newspapers went out to the battlefield like they had. But in times past, the method of getting the story back was either you carried it back or you used some sort of messenger system, whether it be birds or whether it be other human beings. But that all took time. And so in times past, it might be weeks after a battle took place that news arrived. One of the battles in American history that propelled a man to presidency was a moot battle. When Andrew Jackson defeated the British at New Orleans, the war was over. If there had been instant communication, the battle had never been there, and who knows whether he'd have ever been president of the United States. The electronic age was coming about in the Civil War. Telegraph. And so reporters would go out to the field. They would send back their stories instantly. And so if the battle was in the morning, if New York had an afternoon-evening paper, the story could be reported that day. If not, it would be on the morning newspaper. Instantaneous reporting. It wasn't Vietnam. It was the Civil War. With every new technology, there's a problem. We have problems with our computers when a new software program comes out. You buy a new model of a car, and historically, there's problems with it. And such was with the telegraph. Sometimes it broke down for no explained reason. Sometimes it was the enemy breaking down the wires. Sometimes it was just stupid human failures that caused things to happen. And so, traditional journalism was to write the story out, send it out. Guy writes back, your editor writes back, says, what happened after the first sentence? The wire didn't bring the story. So, the method of who, what, where, when, why, and how was a journalism thing out of the Civil War. Get that first sentence out there, get the whole story, and then fill in the details later. It's a good, good study method. If you're looking for a real study help in the Bible, Who, what, where, when, why, and how are things that you can apply to whatever it is that you're studying. I want to utilize this, and we're going to take in a whole gamut of study or disciplines. And the first is grammar. I don't have perfect grammar. My wife reminds me of that all the time. I think I write beautifully. She reminds me. She writes perfect grammar. Pretty stunning. Don't tell her that John. John's pretending like he didn't hear that. He did, and it'll get back. But grammar is terribly important. And for the Bible student, grammar is essential to understanding. Everybody go to Matthew 12 and 22, whatever your translation. I've got the New King James up here. Most are going to be similar. Then one was brought to him who was demon-possessed, blind and mute. And he healed him so that the blind and mute man both spoke and saw. And I italicized spoke and saw. There's an element of grammar that's very important to the storyline in this. Dealing with spoke and saw. Anybody know what that is? Okay? That's a technique. It's not a grammar thing. There. But I see what you're saying. Okay, when this man now is able to speak and able to see, was this a one-time thing? He could do it from then on. And that's what the grammar is. Now, that's an element of grammar that's a present indicative active, what it's called. It means it continues on. It's not a one-time thing. It'd be a horrible thing, wouldn't it, for this man if he had this one instance when he could speak and see and then had to go back to it. But it's a continual action. And we can say, well, that's logical that it would be that way, but the grammar verifies that it is. In a similar type sense, if I use the two-word, and I understand it's not a full sentence, but if I use the two-word sentence, I-R-E-A-D, can you pronounce that two ways? What's one way? I read, and what's the difference? Present indicative. It's a continual thing. I read indicates something I continually do. I read is past. It's a past indicative. It's done. It's over. And it can say I'm not going to do it again. So grammar helps us to understand things about the scripture. So if you happen to be still in school, and you're in business school, and they tell you, well, you don't need to take literature. Take it. Take it. It broadens your horizon to be able to understand this. It gives you those kinds of tools. One of the disciplines that we can help in 1 Corinthians 11th chapter, getting back to here, history. Having an understanding of history helps us to understand what was motivating their question. What was going on at Delphi? I know everybody says Delphi, whatever way you want. What was going on at Delphi? There was an oracle. There was a great temple there. Who were the oracles? Women. How did the women go about their oracles? Everybody hear that? He's exactly right. They sat over vents in an enclosed area with a veil over their head to be able to capture gases that were escaping out of the ground, and the most prominent gas that was escaping was ether, which put you into a hypnotic trance-like state, not enough to knock you out, but to put you in kind of a la-la land. And the gases didn't always come, so they had their seasons when they would go in. But the women were the ones who went in, and they went in. They were viewed as religious people in their setting. And they were revered. Now, actually, the women didn't give the oracle to the one who was receiving the message. The woman went out and gave it to the man, and the man gave it to whoever was seeking this. And then, of course, the money was exchanged over it. But the Greek people located at Corinth, Corinth and Delphi were not very far apart. Delphi was the religious center of Achaia. It was the place where rulers came to get their readings. And that religious person who was receiving that, the way that it was done, it was she, and she had this veil over her. Now, it was a very practical thing. It wasn't necessarily religious, but it's always interpreted as a religious thing. And so the women at the church at Corinth, seeing religious women in their society, putting this over their head before they received or uttered godly things, and their question was, should we? And Paul, in many ways, you might say, took a politician's response to this. And it's not. He deftly tries to tell them that, okay, here's a compromise on this. Because we have a clash of cultures. We have the Greeks that might be veiled. We have the Hebrews. And we have the Romans who wouldn't be. Rather than have conflict, the issue here is not the proper attire. What was the problem at the church in Corinth in this situation? How does he start out in that 11th chapter? Aha! In their whole practice of Christianity, they'd forgotten what was important. And so he says, this is no mystery. Christ is the head of the church. God is the head of Christ. And is the head of woman. If we can all remember that, and that's as much a chastisement of men as it is women. You know, it's easy for men to lord it over everybody and forget that we have a head ourselves. And so he says, you put these things together, and then all the rest is a moot point. But if you want to have something tangible, here it is. Women be women, men be men. And if you're still going to argue about this, you don't have a custom. What he's definitely done is stepped away from that linking of the church back to Delphi. You see, if he'd said, yeah, you need to be veiled, or no, he's entered into the debate dealing with the issue at Delphi. He walked right around that, didn't he? History helps us to understand that. So those are disciplines that are outside the scripture that help, because Paul was dealing with a localized problem. Now, it translates to us in a lot of different ways. These same kind of problems, not necessarily availing, but the same kind of issues can come up. That's why it's preserved for us, to have a pattern how to deal with situations where especially we forgot who the head is. easy to do. Thoughts on that? See, I differ a whole lot from the NIV translators and New American Standard translators. Right. Mm-hmm. Right. Yep. I think we can get into obviously how long is long, how short is short. And basically it's an issue. It's women be styled with women, men be styled with men. So Absalom, I don't know. I don't know whether he was naturally curly, but he did a lot with his hair, and that's a questionable area. And women then, if a woman had a flat top, I'd have probably an issue, not so much with the length of it, but the styling of it. But you see how outside disciplines then help us. What I'm really getting down to is, you never stop studying. Not just the Bible. Borders, Barnes & Noble, or your local library should be some of your favorite places to be. Indiana University Library. It's huge. And I realize there are a lot of universities that are big in their library. A lot of libraries have old documents that you can't find anywhere else. Now, they won't let you check them out, but they'll let you read them. You might want to cultivate. And for a lot of people, you'll have to take notes. You'll not remember it. There's some sitting in this room here that, they won't need to take notes. Okay. 1 Corinthians, and what time am I at? 1:30? Okay. I think we've got time to do this. Who, what, when, and so forth, application. 1 Corinthians 14:34. This is one of those areas when everybody got that? 1 Corinthians 14:34. What's it say? Can I read it out? Okay. Women. That's who he's speaking to. What women? Now here's one of those interdisciplinary things. If you have an Englishman's concordance, especially on a computer, that's so easy on a computer. Paul uses this word 65 times in his writings. 65 times he uses the Greek word gune. 19 of them, oddly enough, appear in 1 Corinthians 11th chapter. And in each one of those references, he's talking about women in general. In all 46 other times, what is he referring to? Why? So, when we get into this in 1 Corinthians 14:34, chances are, without looking at beyond this opening statement, he's talking about wives. Okay, now it's verified later on, but that's one of those disciplines that you can use. Now that's, remember the New King James translator who said, our difficulty with symponia was, it's only used 3 times. And it's all here in Daniel, all in the 3rd chapter. So they didn't have it to compare with other areas. That is an outstanding study point. See how a word is used everywhere else. Doesn't solidify as a fact that that's what it means here, but it sure leans heavy. Lonnie deals with terms of preponderance. No, not really. You're a criminal. You don't care about preponderance. A preponderance is you keep getting things building up, and the scales then are going to tip that way. In civil law, preponderance is the rule. Well, in criminal law, it's supposed to be not inclusive. So, the weight here says wives. The rest of the chapter is going to verify that. Now, which wives? I didn't have a witch in that list, did I? Threw you a curveball. Okay, so now, we're going to start limiting, because we've got a lot of different kinds of women, don't we? We don't have blonde women and brunette women. But first of all, he's speaking to women who are not only married, but married to a specific type of man. What type of man? Men who are in the church. So you see how we're start limiting this down and narrowing the scope. And so we've got women who are married, but may be married to outsiders. Now, would Paul be telling them to ask about spiritual matters of outsiders? Well, no, not at all. And yet all of us have seen situations probably where there was a woman who was married to a man who wasn't in the church and unfortunately got her advice spiritually from that individual, and it's disastrous. So he is pinpointing that. He's not talking about the women who are married to non-Christians. He's not talking to women who are widows. He's not talking to women who are in the church who aren't either old enough to be married or aren't married, whatever the circumstances may be. So there's a host of different types of women, but he's not talking to women in general. Now, the point of this, women aren't to speak in the assembly, in the congregation. And I guess the question is why? Why shouldn't they speak? Okay, we have men are supposed to be leading, but in this situation, why does he tell them not to speak? Okay, what do you suppose these women were asking that didn't need to be asked in the services? Well, what sort of questions? He said questions that they should be asking their husbands. What sort of questions? Okay. How broad-based is that? Well, do you think so? Covers everything? Anything about what? Okay. Spiritually. If this wife who has a Christian husband needs information about her own salvation, should she wait until she gets home to find out about it? Is she prohibited from finding out what she needs to know for her salvation in the services? What was going on in the service? What's the focal point of the activity that was happening there? Now, I'll admit there was a lot of activity going on in various places. And there were people who were tromping on one another with whatever they were doing. We have tongues. Prophecies, interpretations, all of these things were acquired by study. So the subject at hand, when we joined these things all together, was dealing with the activity of spiritual gifts within the assembly. Now, does that help you pinpoint what questions they were asking that give you a direction as to what they may have been asking and how they were adding to the confusion? Don't get the idea that they were the sole cause of the confusion. It's very clear the men were equally guilty here.
But
among the men and the women, they're all guilty. The congregation is guilty of it. And I realize I'm using a generality because there was probably a number of people that didn't open their mouth at all. Didn't do a thing. There's people in the pews here that are never going to open their mouth. And that's okay. You don't have to. No requirement. But the women, in their part, were adding to the confusion by asking their husbands why. What does this point to? That could be easily answered at home. Let's say if a woman had a question about the necessity of taking the Lord's bread and fruit of the vine. Would the answer to that be edifying to the congregation? Could it be a salvational type issue for her? Sure. You think that's the kind of question she's supposed to delay and find out later? Now, if she's got a real issue here, and would she be falling into a category of eating and drinking unworthily? Well, yeah, there's a great risk there. And the consequence of that is damnation, isn't it? So would Paul say you can't resolve salvational issues in the assembly? Well, no. That's part of it. We come together to resolve those issues. So, what kind of questions would she be asking that he says, ask it at home? Pardon? Okay. What kind of questions, though? Well, that's one of those things. What do you want for supper? There's an interesting thing. Why aren't you talking? Fred, do your part. Why aren't you talking? Or, more to the point, let's say her husband is one of those that's prophesied. What kind of a question might she ask him about that? How do you do that? I know you. I've been married to you all these years. How can you speak Latin? I know where you went to school. How do you do that? Well, now, how's that profitable to anybody? Well, it's not. Ask that question at home. It doesn't have anything to do with salvation, and it has everything to do with the subject. It has everything to do with the subject. One of the problems that, especially, I think, more so than anybody else, is Pentecostals pulling a solitary verse out of the context of the whole subject and basing a doctrine on it. But if we put all things together, find out who he's talking about, who they're to be talking to, where they're supposed to be talking, and where they're not supposed to be talking, we understand the why is to not interrupt the services, and we can probably get a better handle on the questions that they were asking. Don't think that this means that unmarried women and widowed women and women who aren't old enough to be, are allowed to interrupt the services. They aren't. It gets back to the whole summation of it. Let everything be done decently in order. But the specific problem with this interruption had to do with women whose husbands experienced these supernatural abilities. And they were helping. Now, you can't blame them that people weren't being edified because the men were at fault too. One man's speaking, nobody's interpreting. One man's prophesying, nobody can hear him because this guy over here is prophesying. And if you put the whole thing together, remember back in the 11th chapter, how they took the Lord's Supper? They weren't any more together on that than they were in this. It's almost like a pep rally that's gone bad. Because nobody's in unison on this. And the net result is, you come together not for the better, but for the worse. So, these are just some of the interdisciplinary facets that you can utilize. Make sure of your Bible. Don't be stuck on one. Utilize what work others have done. Utilize all the disciplines. Grammar, history, geography. We didn't even get into that. Geography plays a big portion in what happens in the narratives of the Bible. Utilize these inner questions about what you read. Now, one of the worst things that a church can do, and has often been the mantra, that's the way we always do it. The worst thing that we can do. Doesn't mean that that's the wrong way. But it means that when you say, that's the way we've always done it, you haven't asked who, what, when, where, why, and how, and come to a intellectual decision, it's based on the scripture. It's based on tradition. And traditions aren't bad, but when we have traditions only for traditions, we've got a problem. So, that's it. Utilize everything. I hope everybody in their school experience had a Miss Throckmorton. I had a Miss Throckmorton in 7th grade English. She was probably 8 foot tall. Of course, I was tiny. I didn't hit 5 foot until I was in high school. So, she wasn't that tall, but she looked that tall. She had white hair. She had to be at least 110 years old then. And man, was she ever mean in English. I thank her every day, nearly. Because without her help, I'd have a whole lot more struggles with the Bible. I'm grateful for L.C. Roberts, who dealt with history with me, and he was an exacting man who wasn't very patient when you were wrong. But I appreciate it. And I thank the experience that I had with him. But never stop with what you had at one point. There's another horizon to look at. There's another book to read. There's another new thing to learn. That won't expose anything different than the Bible, but may expose something different than you're thinking about. It may be so very important. Well, let's close with prayer and bread, would you leave it to me?